Out of the tree of life, I just picked me a plum.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and that's the best is yet to come. Who else? Frank Sinatra. Born on this day in Hoboken, New Jersey in 1915. He was one of the greatest singers in the history of American popular music, sold over 150 albums, and of course considered an icon of American pop culture. We are going to welcome to the airwaves once again the DeWitt Clinton Professor of History at Columbia University, Dr. Eric Foner. His latest book is The Fiery Trial, Abraham Lincoln and American Slavery. And Eric Foner, welcome back. Good to have you with us. But this book was amazing to me. And let me tell you why. There's a lot of things that I think that were – I read some of the critiques of the book. And that – a lot of the critiques that I read, and I want to ask you some questions about that in a few minutes. But one of the things – they seem like a subtext to me, and I like maybe I'm just reading too much into this. I'm sure you'll tell me if I am. That we've always had this historic argument in America about why the Civil War was fought. It was about slavery. It wasn't about slavery. It was economic issues, and slavery just happened to be a byproduct of that war. But one of the pieces that just spoke to me in this book was if it wasn't about slavery that caused the Civil War, it was about race and the complexity of the issue of race in America that affected Lincoln and everybody else?
Well, yes, of course. Race is the most complex issue that our society has ever faced, and Lincoln grappled with it and changed his ideas about it over the course of his life. I don't think you can actually separate slavery and race in some ways. I mean, obviously they are distinct. Slavery is a giant economic system. It's a political system. But it is a racial system, too. Slavery, we have racial slavery in this country. You know, not every slave system is racial. Africa had slavery of black people enslaving other black people. The Roman Empire had slavery, but there were no racial difference between the owners and the slaves. So it made a big difference. It is racial slavery that helps to embed racism so deeply in our society. And a man like Lincoln, who deeply hated slavery, there's no question about that, it took him a long time to be able to think of America as a really a biracial society. He couldn't, for much of his life, he couldn't quite think of black people as an intrinsic part of the United States. He saw them as a kind of an alien group who had been unnaturally brought here from Africa. And, you know, for much of his life, not at the end, but for much of his life, his solution to the problem was freeing the slaves and encouraging them to leave the country, go to Africa, go to Haiti, go to Central America, where they could have their own nationality and not be part of this larger American society. Now, he changes, but that was a very common idea because people couldn't really see through to a society of racial equals in America.
I mean, I think one of the things that people don't really understand, it's explained thoroughly in your book, is that even those who oppose slavery, other than the group we'll talk about in a minute, the interracial abolitionist movement, even those who thought slavery was wrong, this is a very racist society. People despised black folks, used the N-word, wanted to see black folks out of the country, did not want to see people, didn't think black people should be full citizens or could be full citizens, even if they opposed slavery.
Well, that's something it's hard for students, when I teach this, to quite fathom, and many other people. You could be a legitimately anti-slavery, I mean, really hate slavery, but still hold deeply racist views about black people. You know, there are many grounds for opposing slavery. It violates the principles of the Declaration of Independence, or it makes the United States look hypocritical in the world because we talk about freedom and yet we have slavery. Or allowing slavery to spread into the West will actually impede the prospects of white people. White farmers want to go out there. They don't want to compete with slave labor on plantations. So you can hold racist views about blacks and still want slavery restricted from in its expansion and eventually ended. And Lincoln certainly condemned slavery many times, but and he's not virulently racist. Lincoln is not like one of those politicians back then. There were many who gratuitously insulted black people. He doesn't talk about blacks being intellectually inferior or a criminal element or anything like that. But as I say, he can't quite imagine them as being an integral part of American society.
But even with that, I mean, as you kind of take us through Lincoln's transformation around issues of race and slavery over a 30-year period or more, He began, you talk about this in the state legislature, where he supported a bill that every man should have the right to vote whether or not he owned real estate, except that, as you quote, the elective franchise should be kept pure from contamination by the admission of colored voters.
That's in the 1830s, and Lincoln's view, and it's, as you said, it's the common view of Northerners at that time. You know, Illinois, where Lincoln lived as an adult and where he became a politician, was largely settled from the South until the 1850s. Most of the people Lincoln knew were Kentuckians or Tennesseans or Virginians. They had come to Illinois, a free state, but they brought their racial views with them. You know, Illinois in 1853 passed a law making it illegal for any black person even to enter the state. A black person tried to come into Illinois, he could be arrested, fined. If he couldn't pay the fine, he could be auctioned off to someone who would pay the fine, and he could have to work it. So, you know, Lincoln is living in a deeply racist environment, and it shouldn't be surprising. I'm not trying to excuse him.
Right.
It should not be surprising that he shared the racial prejudices of his environment.
As I've read your books over the years, and I've read most of them.
Great.
And about Lincoln. As you describe Lincoln changing this book, I've kind of feel your own views of Lincoln growing yourself over the years.
You may well be right. You know, I have written a lot about this period. I wrote about the Republican Party before the Civil War,
about
the Reconstruction era. Lincoln plays a part in those books, but this is the first time I ever really deeply studied Lincoln, read all of his writings really carefully, and tried to track out his career in the political context of his time. And I think I probably ended up, I don't know how to put this, more favorably disposed to Lincoln than maybe I started out, because I was well aware of some of these racist comments, but I hadn't quite realized how deeply I think Lincoln changes in the last 2 years of his life and how he comes to really start thinking seriously of America as a biracial society and starts to think about what rights African Americans ought to enjoy once the Civil War is over. You know, he's killed while that transformation is going on, so we don't know where he would have ended up. But you're right. I think my views of Lincoln have matured over time, too, as I studied him more. You know, I read all his works now for the first time, and I think I understand the era better than I did maybe when I was starting out as a historian 40 years ago.
This is something else that struck me in this book, because it made me think of, not quite the same thing, but maybe think a bit of the Tea Parties that we see in America today and the response to not just policies, but to the first African-American president in the history of our country. And that is America of the 1830s and how Lincoln responded to that 1830s, a time of horrible, murderous riots against abolitionists who had just started their new movement, an interracial movement of abolitionists, and the response of America to that rise of that movement.
Well, it was a pretty violent era, and, you know, the response in the North, there weren't a heck of a lot of abolitionists giving speeches in the South.
Right.
There were riots breaking up their meetings not far from where Lincoln lived. Lincoln lived in Springfield, Illinois, down the road about 70 miles in Alton. The great abolitionist editor Elijah Lovejoy was killed by a mob, you know, because they were trying to destroy his printing press. He tried to defend it. He was shot and killed by the mob. And, you know, so abolitionism was not popular in the North. Many people saw them as fanatics. They endangered the Union. And also, abolitionists said not only should slaves be freed, but they should be made equal members of society. They were the inventors of the real idea of civil rights for all in this country. And that was not popular in the North. You're completely right. And Lincoln talks about this. You know, Lincoln is a lawyer. Lincoln's a politician. Lincoln is a person who believes in the rule of law. He condemns these riots. He condemns mob action. He says we've got to make it our civil religion to respect the rule of law. But that poses a problem for Lincoln, because slavery is a legal institution. Slavery is in the Constitution. Slavery is supported by law in the southern states. Well, if you believe in the rule of law, how can you oppose slavery then?
And
you have to kind of figure that out as time goes along.
You see, and it's a complexity of that. Even when you look at, when you talk about people like Seward, William Seward, who ended up in the cabinet of Abraham Lincoln, and believed that blacks should have the right to vote, you talk about that in the earlier part of the book, where he also though thought of the African race, as you put in here, as an exotic element in American life, incapable of quote assimilation and absorption, end quote.
Well, so, you know, that was the mode of thinking of that era. People thought about race as the fundamental building block of society. The world was divided, and Seward is one of them, like many others, Emerson, many others. The world is divided into different races. Each race has its own inborn characteristics. White Anglo-Saxons are aggressive and dynamic, you know. Blacks are kind of feminine in a way. They're not dynamic. They're not aggressive. They're not ambitious. They may be very religious and musical, etc., you know, but they're not the kind who can really go out and get it done, you know. And then there were Asians and others of different, you know, so that's how they thought. There were inborn characteristics. There are different races. And Seward is just saying that, you know, look, there are different races in this country, and so the white race is the one that's going to really rule because they have the qualities which are necessary to rule the society. And blacks, yeah, they should have their rights, absolutely. That doesn't mean you make them slaves because they have different characteristics, but they're going to kind of fall by the wayside in the kind of struggle for existence.
I kept thinking as I was reading this book about the kind of historic roots of racism in America, and you can also feel the 21st century images of that kind of racism mirrored in our thoughts today, but couched in very careful terms.
Well, you know, I don't like to attribute motives to people when they're not saying it, but I do feel you're quite right that, you know, in some of the discourse we have, Tea Party, the people who claim that President Obama is not really an American.
Right.
He was born somewhere else. He's a Muslim. He's a secret Muslim. He doesn't really admit it, but he's not one of us. And I think, you know, right beneath the surface in that is obviously a racial view of who is a real American and who is not a real American. Obama is, you know, is a terrorist or sympathizes with terrorism. In other words, he's part of the other. He's not part of us. And you hear that, obviously. There are 20% of the people who think Obama is not an American, which is absurd, you know. But nonetheless, that's a way. It's illegitimate now. You know, in the 19th century, you read my book, you read the language of the time, it's pretty shocking. People are explicitly racist. You know, Stephen A. Douglas, Lincoln's rival, says, no, I don't care about black people.
Right.
People have no rights in this country. You know, this is a white man's country. Now, you don't hear people saying that anymore. That kind of language is delegitimized. But you have other forms of language which raise the question of whether black people really are fully American, and you certainly hear that around nowadays, directed at President Obama.
But when you talked about his belief, and many people who thought slavery should be abolished belief in that blacks should leave America and go to Africa, they should go to the West Indies, and even through 1862, that far into his life and that far into the Civil War, is it the Cherokee project? He even was going to have American funds developed to help black folks be moved to Columbia voluntarily.
Right. Well, Lincoln believes that from 1852 when he endorses the idea in a speech about his great political idol, Henry Clay, down through the Emancipation Proclamation. I think the real key here is the proclamation because that announces a different way of getting rid of slavery. Up to that point, Lincoln thought you get rid of slavery by a gradual plan where you will pay the slave owners compensation for the loss of their property, and you will encourage black people to leave the country. Lincoln never favored, you know, compulsory deportation, but he wanted to make it very clear that they should leave. Now, with the Emancipation Proclamation, that's a different plan. It's immediate. It's not gradual. There's nothing in it about paying the slave owners anymore. And there's nothing in it about sending blacks out of the country. Quite the reverse. He now invites black men to join the Union Army for the first time. That's a very different vision of their role in the society than saying you got to get out of the country. Now they can fight and die for the Union. And Lincoln very quickly comes to say, well, that gives them a stake in the society. That gives them a claim to citizenship. If you're in the Army and fighting for the nation, well, you're part of the nation then, you know, and so we can't really think of you now as some exotic group who's going to leave the country. So in the last 2 years of his life, I think Lincoln really starts to think seriously for the first time of what a post-war America will look like with African-Americans as part of the society.
But this period of his life, when he believed in that, this was, I mean, the opposition from the black community, I think, is important to talk about.
Absolutely.
And their response to Lincoln's speeches.
Blacks who said, yeah, you know, Lincoln is right. We're never going to get rights here. Let's go to Africa. There were some emigrations. There was the African Civilization Society run by blacks. But the vast majority of black Americans said, absolutely not, Lincoln, or anyone. Jefferson, who thought this, Clay, we are Americans. We are not Africans. We are not Central Americans. We are not West Indians. We are Americans. What we want is our rights in this country. Lincoln met in 1862 with a group of black leaders, and he said to them, look, you go out among your people and advocate for emigration from the country. There were, when this was published, there were all these letters that poured into the White House and into black newspapers by people saying, wait a minute, we have as much right to be here as Lincoln does, you know? So the black community's repudiation of colonization is a major reason why it never got anywhere.
I want to ask you this question. When you see the changes that took place in Lincoln between the emancipation and his death in 1865, how much do you put at the what was going on in the country that forced, some people would argue, forced his hand in emancipation, or how much the process itself and the pushing of the abolitionists and others had in changing Lincoln?
It's all of the above. Lincoln hated slavery. That's true. The abolitionists and radicals were pressing Lincoln as soon as the Civil War began toward emancipation. Militarily, it came to be seen as a necessary measure. You couldn't just win the war without attacking the economic infrastructure of the South, the bases, which was slavery. They needed black troops in the army, and the way to get that was to go to emancipation. So there are numerous causes for emancipation. But as you say, this question of growth of Lincoln, I think, is very important. You know, Lincoln had an open mind. Lincoln was curious. Lincoln was willing to listen to critics. He didn't just surround himself with yes men. And, you know, not everybody changes. Events are very important, but not everybody responds to events. For example, look at Lincoln's successor.
Andrew Johnson.
He comes in when Lincoln is killed in a great crisis over Reconstruction, and he can't change. He's totally stubborn. He's totally inflexible. He puts forward a policy, and he won't consider any criticism. He's closed-minded. He lacks all the qualities that Lincoln has of statesmanship. So it's not just the circumstances, it's the person and whether he has the character to actually respond.
I wonder, as we approach this sesquicentennial of the Civil War, mm-hmm. your book, and where do you think we're going to go as a country? We're about to revisit this era and its effect on America.
There's still a lot of debate, as you said at the beginning. You know, there's a lot of people who refuse to admit that slavery was the basic cause of the Civil War. There's a lot of people who find that kind of uncomfortable to talk about slavery and its major role in American history. The question of race is still roiled in this country. It's not been settled. So, you know, in a sense, in commemorating the 150th anniversary of the Civil War, we are likely to have similar kinds of debates because those issues are still with us. You know, there is no general consensus about some of the basic issues that arose in the Civil War. So I foresee 150th anniversary celebrations, which are divisive in some ways because we're still divided about these questions.
Do we have time for one more quick call?
One more
before we go to break, and Eric Forn asked Steve. Matt, you're on the air for a very quick thought.
Yes, I wish I had more time because there's so many issues.
Right, we don't, though. We'll do it another day, though.
I just want to say that from what I understand, the word slave came from the Slavonic region, yes, where the Moors would go down and take slaves at that time that would be considered white. And even during slavery in America, they had a group that was constantly buying their relatives out of slavery over in the Middle East that were white.
That is
so true. I think when people start thinking that they are superior because people happen to be of color that was slaves.
Well, now, Matt, we only have like 45 seconds left. I really do apologize. I'll let Eric respond very quickly. I'm sorry.
All right.
The gentleman is
I just wanted to make that point.
Matt, but we're just about out of time. So, Eric, do you want to have a thought?
I'm saying that white people have been held in slavery in the Middle East. He's absolutely right, in North Africa. But in the U.S., it was racial slavery. And no person legally declared white, they may look like, but legally white, was ever held as a slave in the United States. And that is a fundamental difference between American slavery and many other forms of slavery.
A very powerful point that you made very well in your critique of Pinscher's book. Eric Foner, thank you so much. We look forward to talking to you again when you have the time.
As always, great.
Thank you so much. Eric Foner's latest book, Fiery Trial, Abraham Lincoln and American Slavery, really well worth the read, an incredible piece of American history. On our way to break, we're hearing More Than Likely by Joe Williams, born on this day in 1918.
More than likely, I'll get that bug again.